Save big on everything for your next outdoor project when you shop at Menards. Greenworks 40-volt cordless tools have everything you need to keep your yard looking great. The Greenworks cordless trimmer and edger is lightweight, starts instantly, and comes with a 40-volt battery and charger. Pick one up today, on sale, now through June 1st. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
It's not every day that a capital murder trial drops a bombshell before jury selection even begins. And that's exactly what happened with Brian Koberger's defense team, and they walked through the courtroom door on May 15th and told the judge quietly through a sealed filing that someone else might have done it. That's right, nearly 2 years of legal buildup, the defense has officially pointed the finger elsewhere. Not at a press conference, not in the media, but right there in court, filing paperwork that accuses an unnamed alternate suspect of the murders that took place at the University of Idaho campus in November of 2022. Now, before anyone pictures a courtroom gasping like it's some sort of a scene from a courtroom drama, let's ground this in reality. There was no clutch the pearls. Even making that noise makes me need to cough. The filing was sealed, which means we don't yet know who this alleged alternate suspect is or what exactly ties them to the crime. But we do know the court is taking it seriously enough to schedule a separate hearing, an evidentiary one, for June 18th. And the judge made something very clear. If this alternate theory is going to make it in front of a jury, it better come with receipts, real evidence, no speculation, no, oh, this is another person who likes to look at the stars, an unnamed man who just likes to frolic in the night breeze, staring into the sky, and then occasionally, oh, wandering into a college home and killing people. Someone just like Brian. But it's not Brian. It's Brian's doppelganger. Have you heard of doppelgangers? They're out there. They're real. They are. I'm assuming it might be more than that, but you never really quite know in this case. So, the defense is until May 23rd to hand over whatever they have to support this theory. If it doesn't meet that threshold, the jury may never hear a word of it. So they better have something. So why now? Why wait until May 2025 when Koberger has been in custody since the end of 2022? Well, there's a strategic part. This late night reveal may not be about convincing the public. It's about court rules and evidentiary standards. The defense had to show its cards eventually. And with the trial looming, they've chosen now. The prosecution, they're not thrilled. They've warned the court about a shotgun approach where the defense might throw out vague suspicions without anything substantive to back it back up. The judge seems to agree. No surprises once the jury is sworn in, so you better bring it. This wasn't the only big deal and big legal maneuver the defense brought to the table the other week. They also took aim at the biggest piece of prosecutorial leverage on the table, the death penalty. Koberger's attorneys have asked the judge to remove it altogether, arguing that two main factors make it unjust in this case. Their first argument is diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder, because you can't kill someone with autism spectrum disorder. They don't know what they're doing. Oh, wait, they do. They fully know exactly what they're doing. And you know what? Huge chunk of the population is in this group. And it's not to say it's a bad thing. Hi, I'm there too. Not on the murderous end, but on the highly, extremely productive end of it. And it's a spectrum for a reason. And second, the overwhelming mountains of discovery materials that have been expected to be sorted through. thousands of pages, digital records, files from multiple agencies, and some allegedly disorganized or locked in formats they can't even access, which is really just kind of BS. They can access anything they want over there. It's there for them. There's a lot. I'll give them that. But it's been there. They've had it. They've been making up stories for the last 2.5 years, you know, about stars and all sorts of fun things. Maybe it's time you look at what you actually got, because it doesn't seem you got much. So, autism, and there's a lot of work. I don't think that that's quite going to add up to we may not kill him. Because if it turns out D is the guy who did it, and it looks like he's the guy who did it, and F autism, well, I think we might have a good candidate for the firing squad, don't you? Because if him, then who? I should say, if not him, then who? I mean, he took out 4 college students in a whim. So, I think the world wouldn't be that bad of a place without Brian Koberger sharing the oxygen, if in fact it is him. The autism angle here is important. Koberger's team isn't saying he's mentally unfit to stand trial. They're saying that his neurodivergence affects how he processes emotion, communication, and behavior, traits that look cold or disconnected to a jury unfamiliar with autism. Well, that's because they're cold and disconnected. And even if you have autism, you still have to live in the society with everybody else, and you got to play by everybody else's rules. You can't just go kill people because you feel cold and disconnected. That doesn't get you a free pass. It doesn't get you a get out of the death penalty free card. Sorry. The defense is preparing for a scenario where if he's convicted, they'll argue that his autism is a mitigating factor that should steer the jury away from recommending death. The judge didn't rule on that motion right away, but he did issue one clear boundary. The prosecution cannot use Koberger's autism against him. In other words, the state can't walk into the penalty phase and say, look how emotionless he is. That's proof he's a monster. Even though it is proof he's a monster. That door is now closed. The defense may still use a diagnosis as part of their mitigation strategy, but only after a conviction and only during sentencing. For now, autism is officially off limits in arguments about guilt. But courtroom strategy isn't just about filings and diagnoses. It's about how the room looks, who's sitting where, and what the jury actually sees. One request from the defense may sound simple, but it carries emotional weight. They want Koberger's parents and sisters to be allowed to attend the trial in full. That's complicated because they're also on the witness list. Normally, witnesses can't sit in on testimony before they take the stand. It could taint their memory or influence their vision or version of events. Prosecutors objected, arguing that letting them stay would mean reshuffling the trial just so the family could be in the room. The judge hasn't ruled on that yet, but he didn't shut it down either. In fact, he acknowledged how devastating this process must be for Koberger's family. They didn't commit a crime, but they're living inside its aftermath from their alleged monster son. Whether the court finds a way to accommodate them by having them testify early, for example, remains to be seen. For now, it's an open question with real emotional and psychological stakes. All of this is playing out against a backdrop of a trial that's now officially locked in. Jury selection begins on July 30th. Opening statements are set for August 11th, and the trial will run weekdays with standard court hours, and the plan includes 8 alternate jurors. That last part is crucial. With a trial this long and high profile, it's not uncommon for jurors to be dismissed for health reasons, emergencies, or even potential misconduct. The final 12 will be chosen randomly from the group at the end, ensuring the defense and prosecution don't try to game the system based on how the trial unfolds. There's also the matter of how Koberger appears in court, something his defense is subtly working into the narrative. He's been described as stoic, stone-faced, unemotional. If the jury doesn't know he's autistic, those traits could be misread as coldness or guilt, which... It is. It's a quiet but calculated decision to lean into that diagnosis now, not just to humanize him, but to start shaping how he's perceived. It's not about excusing anything. It's about planting the idea that what might look like apathy is really a neurological wiring. It's not a small thing when your client's life is on the line. The hearing didn't end with fireworks or a Perry Mason moment. It ended with structure. The judge made very clear that surprises are over. From here on out, the rules of engagement are in place and both sides have their deadlines. Koberger's team must deliver on the alternate suspect evidence by May 23rd. The prosecution must respond to motions within the same window, and by June 18th, we'll have a hearing to determine whether this theory even makes it past the courthouse doors and into the minds of a jury. Don't hold your breath. That's where things start to shift away from legal positioning and towards the actual narrative that will unfold in the courtroom. And that means the next battle is over what the jury will be allowed to see, hear, and feel once the actual trial begins. If the defense's strategy was the headline coming out of the May 15th hearing, then the quieter but just as consequential subplot was this. What exactly will the jury be allowed to see, hear, and emotionally process when Brian Koberger's trial begins? Because in a courtroom, truth isn't just about facts, it's about framing. And this hearing was where Judge Stephen Hippler started drawing those lines. Let's start with the evidence. Because while no new exhibits were formally submitted in court, the prosecution made it very clear what's coming. They intend to present a series of key pieces that they believe link Koberger directly to the crime scene and to the planning that preceded it. That includes his Amazon purchase history, specifically a K-bar knife prosecutors believe is consistent with the wounds found on the victims. There's also Koberger's own academic writing, essays, term papers from his criminology studies that allegedly detail how a person might commit a perfect crime or analyze a crime scene without leaving traceable evidence. So there's that. Prosecutors see these writings not as abstract casework or coursework, but as potential blueprints, a behavioral echo of what they claim he later carried out. Then there's the cell phone data. According to earlier filings, Koberger's phone had pinged near the crime scene multiple times in the weeks leading up to the murders, including a brief window immediately after the killings. Prosecutors are expected to map this data out for the jury to show not just proximity, but what they argue is stalking behavior. Repeated visits, a deep familiarity with the location, and a suspicious dark window where the phone is switched off, only to reappear near the house once again. That gap, they'll argue, is no accident. Surveillance footage is also expected to play a central role, where a white Hyundai Elantra, the same make and model registered to Koberger, was reportedly spotted on multiple cameras driving near the victim's home during the early morning hours of the murders. So there's that too. The prosecution plans to show that the vehicle's movements, its speed, its timing, its proximity to the scene aren't random, but part of a coordinated act. And guess who's probably behind the wheel? Brian Koberger. And then there's the DNA, perhaps the most tangible piece of forensic evidence in the case. It's the knife sheath recovered from the crime scene. According to investigators, DNA found on the button strap of the sheath matches Koberger's, and it was located near one of the victim's bodies. This, prosecutors argue, is not just circumstantial. It is physical proof that he was in the room where the killings occurred. All of this is part of the state's plan to construct a narrative of preparation, proximity, and presence. But how that narrative gets told, how the jury hears it, sees it, and emotionally reacts to it, was a subject of significant pushback from the defense. Koberger's attorneys argued that certain elements of the state's case are more prejudicial than probative. Specifically, they asked the court to restrict the use of terms like murderer, psychopath, or any other emotionally charged language during the evidentiary phases of the trial. Their position was clear. Let the evidence speak for itself. Oh, and speak it will. Let the facts come out clean without inflammatory labels that could bias the jury before all sides have been heard. Judge Hippler agreed in part. He ruled that during the trial's evidentiary phase, attorneys and witnesses must avoid calling Koberger a murderer or using similarly prejudicial language. That restriction, however, will lift during closing arguments. When both sides are expected to make their final case and interpret the evidence as they see fit, in other words, prosecutors can argue he is the murderer, just not until they've presented all the evidence that allegedly proves it. Another point of contention was the use of graphic evidence, crime scene photos, autopsy images, and other visuals that could be emotionally devastating to jurors. Well, guess what? You're a juror. This is a murder trial, and this is what you get. The defense pushed for a blanket restriction. The court didn't go that far. Instead, Judge Hippler ruled that graphic evidence will be considered on a case-by-case basis. He acknowledged the need to show jurors the reality of the crime, but emphasized that gratuitous repetition or unnecessary brutality will not be permitted. It's a delicate balance between honesty and emotional manipulation, and the judge made it clear he'll be the one managing that scale. Besides or beyond what happens inside the courtroom, there's also the question of what the public will be allowed to see. Judge Hippler confirmed that the trial will be live streamed with fixed cameras showing the bench, the witness stand, the counsel tables. No zooming, no sweeping shots of the gallery, a clean static feed, which, of course, we will carry here for you with breakdowns every single day. But there are exceptions, the most notable. If the two surviving roommates from the victim's house testify, their identities will be protected. Their faces won't appear on camera, and live streaming will be shut off during their testimony. The court ruled that the trauma they've already endured, combined with their role as surviving victims, justifies limiting public access in those moments. It's not just about cameras, though. The court is also managing who gets to be physically present in the room. Judge Hippler said there will be reserved seating for both the victims' families and Koberger's families, up to four members on each side. This ensures that people most directly affected by the case have a presence in the courtroom. But it also reflects the court's awareness that high emotion and media scrutiny can't be allowed to interfere with due process. Judge Hippler spoke directly to the attorneys about what he expects in this trial. He used a metaphor, one that's now been quoted widely. He compared the trial to a gumbo. You don't judge the soup by a single ingredient. You let everything simmer, then taste the final result. That's what a jury will do, he said. They'll listen to every witness, see every piece of evidence, and form a complete picture over time. It's not about shock value or headline moments. It's about the whole meal. And with that metaphor came a warning. Surprises will not be tolerated. If either side is holding back key information, waiting to spring it mid-trial, the judge made it clear that won't fly. Transparency is the rule from here on out. Both sides are under strict orders to disclose expert witnesses, provide final exhibit lists, and resolve any remaining disputes before jury selection begins. What happens next isn't dramatic, but it is pivotal. The court is still reviewing a series of additional motions about forensic testimony, evidence admissibility, and the logistics of jury management. And of course, the June 18th hearing will decide whether the defense's alternate suspect theory gets through the courtroom doors or stops at the threshold. Everything that happens now is about preparing the battlefield, determining the weapons each side is allowed to bring and the rules they'll play by. Because once the jury is sworn in, the real fight begins. What do you think? Where is this going? Does he actually have a chance at somehow changing the narrative on this? The third party culprit theory, that's the big thing. That's appearing what they're now going to try and run with. First, he had the alibi. He likes to look at the stars. Now we got a third party culprit theory. Somebody who doesn't like to look at the stars. Somebody who likes murdering. I don't know. I fear for whoever they're going to try and use as a third party culprit, if they're actually going to use a name. I don't know that they have to. I don't know if they I don't know the rules of that specifically. But they're going to have to be somewhat concise. It can't just be, well, the boogeyman came in and did it, and this is what the boogeyman looks like according to our dreams. But if they start trying to pin it towards people that have nothing to do with this, or even victims, that ain't going to be a good look. And again, this is why all these things happen before the actual trial begins. So the judge can take a look at it and go, yeah, what you're saying is insane and is nowhere near reality. So if, for example, they throw out a third party culprit suspect theory, let's say it names surviving roommates. I mean, just complete theoretical here. Let's say it names somebody who's maybe the DNA they found on the railing. Just people who have literally nothing to do with the death of these kids. That's where the judge can step in and go, nice try, but no cigar. And guess what? That even further hurt your what little bit of image you have. So we'll see where it all goes. Tell me what you think in the comment section here on YouTube or on X, Twitter, wherever you're listening to this. Love to get your thoughts. Be sure to press subscribe if you're listening to the podcast or whatever platform that may be. And if you're watching us, like I said, YouTube, Twitter, X, wherever it is, press subscribe there so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. It is just beginning. We're only 1,000 episodes in, everybody. Which I think we actually are on the Idaho Murders podcast channel, which if you want to watch this case specifically and follow this case alone, we have it for you. Of course, you can get it through the Hidden Killers podcast or True Crime Today. But if you just want to follow this case by itself, on all of our cases, we have individual channels out there for you so you can follow the cases directly by themselves. So the Idaho Murders, the case against Koberger, is the name of that podcast channel. Or wherever you are right here, it's going to keep coming here too. So press subscribe so you don't miss any of that coverage. My name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.